The latest thriller novel from Brad Meltzer supposes that the President of the United States has a private ring of spies. Inner Circle imagines that the spy ring is passed on from one president to the next. Meltzer says his fictional plot grew out of a real-life experience.
A few years ago, the Department of Homeland Security asked me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks.
Mm-hmm.
But I was honored to be part of what they call the Red Cell Program. And the Red Cell Program brings together out-of-the-box thinkers to really look at problems in a very different way. So it would put me with a chemist. They put me with a Secret Service agent, and obviously as a novelist, I was just one of those regular citizens who they brought in.
But it got you thinking about history.
Everything gets me thinking about history and say, where else has this happened? Who else tapped civilians? And George Washington was the first. He started his secret spy ring called the Culpa Ring, and the Culpa Ring helped Washington move information during the Revolutionary War. They used to write in invisible ink. They used to use code names. It was a fascinating thing. Most people didn't even know who they were for over 100 years because they took their secrets to the grave. I went to my national security folks who helped me with the Red Cell program, and I said, what if you found out that George Washington's secret spy ring still existed today? And one of my folks in Homeland Security said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? And I said, what are you talking about? Right? I mean, this is the moment you wait for, right? I said, what are you talking about? And he said to me, why would he ever disband it? And that's when the little hairs go up and you say, okay, I got the plot for my next novel.
If it's a novel.
If it's a novel, right. I might be moving it to the nonfiction side when he told me that. But I became obsessed with looking, okay, how do we do this? If each president has to tell the next president that they have this secret spy ring that was started by George Washington, how do they move that information? And I found this great story. This is a true story that during his last moments in the White House, Ronald Reagan wrote a secret letter to former President Bush, who was taking over that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote, don't let the turkeys get you down. And he left that letter for Bush, who then left a letter for Clinton, who left a letter for W, who left a letter for Obama. It is the greatest secret tradition of the modern presidency. And I thought, you know, what if that's how they move information? So I went to the very best person I could think of to test it. I went to former President George H.W. Bush, the dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent him a letter. And I said, could George Washington's spy ring exist to this very day? And could presidents move the information in that letter that's in the White House office?
This would be the great moment if he said, I can neither confirm nor deny what you're saying or some such thing. But he didn't say that, I suppose.
I was begging for him to say that. What he did is he sent me the actual secret letter he wrote to Bill Clinton in the last moments when Bush was in office. So my first thought is, he sent me a secret code. The truth was, what he did send me was the greatest secret of the U.S. presidency, and it was just that reminder that there are people in this office. We put them on these great pedestals, and we inevitably throw them down these deep ditches, but we forget that they are us. They are still human people doing very human things.
We don't have time here to read the whole text of the letter, but could you just read for me the last couple of sentences, the parting words before—
Yeah, the parting words is, I am rooting hard for you, and I just was so taken by that.
Is there any sense, has there been any sense reported of what those later letters from one president to another have said?
You better believe I've spent the last 6 months of my life hunting those down and trying to find them all. I don't even think these letters are in the archives. These letters are private.
Well, that's interesting since this became part of a novel that you wrote about an archivist working at the National Archives and stumbling upon this great secret of a spy ring dating back to George Washington.
Yeah, and that was the goal is, I had no idea that Bush was going to take it so seriously, but he's helped me with other books in the past, and this one is about George Washington spy ring still existing to this day. We don't know what they're doing or who they work for, but a young archivist in the archives is about to find out, and that's where the Inner Circle opens. It also opens with the story of these letters.
Brad Meltzer's new book is The Inner Circle. Mr. Meltzer, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
For the first time since 1957, the Auburn Tigers are the champions of college football. Auburn won the BCS National Championship last night with a thrilling 22-19 victory over the University of Oregon. They clinched the win with a last-second field goal, just one of many dramatic moments in a game that also delivered some unexpected heroes. NPR's Tom Goldman was there and filed this report.
An electrifying end-of-game comeback by Oregon, a stunning 37-yard run by Auburn, a championship-winning field goal. Much to talk about, but not yet. That's because Auburn's senior linebacker Josh Bynes and his buddies on defense get top billing, finally.
Just like I told defense before we got on the bus to come here, throughout the whole week of preparation and everything before this game, they haven't shown not one defensive highlight. So what that tells us, defense. So basically, we got to play at another level and show them what kind of defense we are today.
So Oregon star running back LaMichael James can blame ESPN. Because that highlight-starved Auburn defense grounded James, he gained only 49 yards. Had his running mate, Kenyon Barner, been able to squeeze out just 1 yard late in the third quarter, how different the outcome might have been. That's the sound of the part of the stadium wearing Auburn orange going nuts. It was fourth down with 1 yard to go for an Oregon touchdown. The Ducks decided not to try a field goal and sent Barner hurtling toward the end zone instead. That roar tells the outcome. Throughout the game, Auburn's defensive line, led by All-American Nick Fairley, manhandled Oregon's offensive line. Leading up to the game, Auburn heard all about Oregon's top-rated offense, averaging more than 49 points per game and doing it at warp speed. But the Tigers were ready, thanks to exhausting preparation, especially for a guy like the 6'5", 298-pound Fairley.
You know, we probably did like 2,000 jump ropes the whole time we was off. So, like I said, they was tired, I was tired. We were just going to see who going to hit who in the mouth last.
With 2.5 minutes left in the game, it became anyone's guess who'd land that last punch. Oregon's defense forced a fumble by Auburn's star quarterback Cam Newton. The Ducks' offense then finally moved the ball down the field. At the 2.5 minute mark, quarterback Darren Thomas flipped a short pass to LaMichael James. That's the yellow half of the stadium going bonkers. Oregon followed the touchdown with a 2-point conversion, 19-19. But the quacking soon faded as Auburn drove back down the field, aided by that aforementioned stunning 37-yard run. Auburn running back Michael Dyer went down in the grasp of an Oregon defender, rolled over, popped up, looked around, and kept going.
All I knew was the whistle wasn't blown and my coach was saying go, and I just kind of continued to get some more yards and keep the play going and keep the balls in the offense hand.
It was ruled that Dyer's knee never hit the ground. He followed up with a run that ended up just short of the goal line. 2 seconds left, Auburn place kicker Wes Byram finished the job, a 19-yard championship-winning field goal. The confetti fell, the Tigers danced, the Ducks shuffled away, this close to their first title ever. And fully aware that this eagerly anticipated game lived up to its billing, even without lots of points on the board. Cliff Harris is an Oregon defensive back.
It was just a battle, you know. I hope y'all enjoyed the show we put on for you guys.
We did, Cliff. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Scottsdale, Arizona.
You don't have to be a good speller to be a good writer. That's the message from the Oregon Department of Education. Tomorrow morning, Oregon students will start taking their standardized writing exams, and for the first time, those doing their essays online will get to use spell check. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Rob Manning reports.
For some students at East Portland's Park Rose High School, using spell check on the state's required writing exam makes a lot of sense. They say it's on word processing software. It's even on their cell phones. Jerry Hunter is a junior. He says spell check is everywhere.
Nobody is a perfect speller, you know. People have gone through school. They haven't been so well at spelling and still have turned out successful. It is a good luxury to have. It is a good tool to just keep with you. So I don't think kids should be denied of that. And I think it's might even benefit us in the future.
But some of Hunter's classmates worry that spell check is a crutch they don't want to rely on. When junior Ashley Smith sits down for her test, she'd rather not have spell check because she won't have it when the SAT or advanced placement exams come along.
If we always constantly use spell check, then what about when we get in situations like that, when we don't have it, we're going to be completely confused and maybe even fail it because it's one of the parts that they grade you on.
Oregon will allow students starting in the seventh grade to use spell check to point out misspelled words, but it won't correct them for the student. It also won't catch grammar mistakes or tell students if they used the wrong spelling of there, for instance. State education officials counter that another important test allows spell check, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, often called the nation's report card. State school superintendent Susan Castillo says it's important to incorporate newer technology into assessments. She's hoping that spell check can help students focus on more abstract writing skills. She compares it to architects who use software to do their actual drafting.
Now, with the use of computers, that work, that basic function work, is done for them, and they are free to be creative and innovative.
This is not to say that English teachers aren't still teaching spelling.
Narissa Adiza teaches English at Park Rose High School.
There's also students who struggle with things like dyslexia or are good writers, but that one little thing gets in the way of them passing, and this is a high-stakes test. They have to pass it in order to graduate.
But not every Oregon student will get to use spell check on their writing exams. That's because despite the Portland area's reputation for technology firms, computer shortages in schools mean only about one quarter of students are expected to take this year's writing test online. Michelle Wood teaches English at David Douglas High, the state's largest high school. Her students won't have computers for the writing test.
You can't compare a student that's taken a hand, paper-pencil test to a student who's typed up a test and had any sort of technological advances like spell check.
Oregon education officials contend that all students can use dictionaries and other spelling tools, but they plan to watch the results closely to see if there's a significant difference. Regardless, they say online testing is the direction the state, and likely the nation, is headed. For NPR News, I'm Rob Manning in Portland.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Amy Chua is a law professor at Yale who's written big think books on free market democracy and the fall of empires. Her new book, however, is a memoir called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, which is about raising her two American daughters in what she describes as the Chinese way. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Chua's approach to parenting is controversial, even scary. But there's no question that her memoir is destined to be one of the most talked-about books of the season.
Amy Chua may well be nuts. What kind of a mother hauls her then 7-year-old daughter's dollhouse out to the car and tells the kid that the dollhouse is going to be donated to the Salvation Army piece by piece if the daughter doesn't master a difficult piano composition by the next day? What kind of a mother informs her daughter that she's garbage? And what kind of a mother believes, as Chua tells readers she does, that an A-minus is a bad grade? The only activities your children should be permitted to do are those in which they can eventually win a medal, and that medal must be gold. What kind of a mother? Why, a mother who's raising her kids the Chinese rather than the Western way. In her new memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, Chua recounts her adventures in Chinese parenting. And nuts though she may be, she's also mesmerizing. Chua's voice is that of a jovial, erudite serial killer. Think Hannibal Lecter, who's explaining how he's going to fillet his next victim as though it's the most self-evidently normal behavior. That's the other gripping aspect of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. There's method to Chua's madness, enough method to stir up self-doubt in readers who subscribe to more nurturing parenting styles. Trust me, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother is going to be a book club and parenting blog phenomenon. There will be fevered debate over Chua's tough love strategies, which include ironclad bans on such Western indulgences as sleepovers, playdates, and any extracurricular activities except practicing musical instruments, which must be the violin or piano. when Chua married her husband, fellow Yale law professor and novelist Jed Rubenfeld. They agreed that their children would be raised Jewish and reared the Chinese way, in which punishingly hard work enforced by parents yields excellence. Excellence, in turn, yields satisfaction in what Chua calls a virtuous circle. The success of this strategy is hard to dispute. Older daughter Sophia is a piano prodigy who played Carnegie Hall when she was 14 or so. The second, more rebellious daughter, Lulu, is a gifted violinist. Chua rode the girls hard, making sure they practiced at least 3 hours a day, even on vacations, when she would call ahead to arrange access to pianos for Sophia in hotel lobby bars and basement storage rooms. Chua also rarely refrained from criticizing her daughters, and in one of the many provocative passages that fill her book, she explains, Chinese parents can do things that would seem unimaginable, even legally actionable, to Westerners. Chinese mothers can say to their daughters, "Hey, fatty, lose some weight." By contrast, Western parents have to tiptoe around the issue, talking in terms of health and never, ever mentioning the F word, and their kids still end up in therapy for eating disorders and negative self-image. Western parents are concerned about their children's psyches. Chinese parents aren't. They assume strength, not fragility, and as a result, they behave very differently. I was on my living room couch reading the end of Chua's memoir when my 12-year-old daughter came downstairs and announced that she had done enough reading for one day, and that since she had also practiced flute for 15 minutes, she was going to kick back and watch TV, in this case, a made-for-TV Disney movie. Chua tartly sums up the stereotypically Western Disney plot this way. In Disney movies, she says, the studious kid always has to have a breakdown and realize that life is not all about following rules and winning prizes and then take off her clothes and run into the ocean or something like that. But that's just Disney's way of appealing to all the people who never win any prizes. Winning prizes gives you opportunities, and that's freedom, not running into the ocean. I looked over at my daughter and had mixed feelings about her just chilling in front of the TV, rather than plugging away in that virtuous circle of enforced practice. I guess I won't be sending out the invitations to Carnegie Hall anytime soon.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother by Amy Chua. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Who could resist the headline, Mysterious Green Blob in Space Explained? That comes from a presentation at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society, and we've asked NPR science correspondent Joe Palca to share the explanation with us. Hiya.
Hi.
And before the explanation, when did astronomers first start investigating this mysterious blob, and is blob actually a technical term among astronomers?
Some, but I think it's, no, it's probably not, but it's close enough. Anyway, they found this thing in 2007, and it was actually found by a school teacher in the Netherlands named Annie van Arco. And she told me at the time she knew almost nothing about astronomy, mm-hmm. but she was looking around on Brian May's website.
Brian May?
Yes, of course. You know Brian May,
the
guitar player for Queen,
uh-huh.
who also happens to have a PhD in astrophysics. Anyway, he had a link on his website to something called the Galaxy Zoo. And this was a project where people were asked to help the astronomers identify and characterize galaxies, and they were just supposed to look at these things and tell them. So Van Arkel sees this bluish-greenish smudge on one of the pictures on the Galaxy Zoo website, and she writes to the people at the website, and she says, what's this smudge?
Mm-hmm.
And they go, we don't know. So they decided to investigate.
Smudge being another
That's another
term.
Yes,
among, mm-hmm. Well, what did they find? What did they think it was?
Well, they were pretty sure that it was a cloud of gas, a huge cloud of gas, almost the size of the Milky Way, that was glowing from some extremely bright object shining behind it. You can kind of think of it as a fog bank being lit up by a floodlight off to the side.
They could see the bright object behind, or they just inferred it was
there? No, they couldn't see a bright object. And that's the thing. When you see something being lit up by a bright object, you want to find the bright object. So that was the mystery in the mysterious green blob. So they started looking around, and they thought, well, a quasar could light this up. And that's that powerful thing at the center of galaxies. But they're bright enough, but there wasn't any quasar around. And they looked for it and looked for it. And finally, they think they've come up with the answer, which was there was a quasar around, but it turned off about 200,000 years ago.
An extinct quasar.
It's an extinct quasar, but in the time that it took for the light to get from the quasar to the cloud, it still had enough light, even though it's now dead. So in about 200,000 years, this cloud will go dark as well.
So the explanation of the green blob is a former quasar behind a lot of stuff.
Behind, or actually they tell me it's off to the side. Because the other thing they see are these jets of sort of a jet wind, they call it, coming out of the quasar. Happens when a quasar gets sucked into a black hole or ends its life near a black hole, and these jets come out and they are actually pushing the cloud around and causing them to actually start to form planets inside this cloud of gas.
And all this came about thanks to the Dutch school teacher.
That's right. And just by the way, if you want to talk to an astronomer about this green blob, you can call it Hannes Verwerp.
Verwerp.
Verwerp. That's the Dutch word for object. So Hanny's object for Hanny von Arco.
Live and learn.
You bet.
NPR's Joe Palca. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise. Playing in the street. Gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face. You big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place. Singing, we will, we will.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
Economists are debating whether to come up with a code of ethics for their profession. This comes in the wake of the financial crisis and questions about faulty forecasting and what some see as a growing distrust of economists. Kirk Ziegler of member station KUNC attended the annual meeting of the American Economics Association in Denver and sent us this report.
A few years ago, one of economist George DeMartino's students asked him a question about ethics he couldn't answer. So the University of Denver professor went to the website of his professional organization, the American Economic Association, or AEA, but he found nothing at all about ethics. Puzzled, he did some research.
In the 1920s, a businessmen's association wrote a letter to the AEA saying, we're studying codes of conduct, please send us yours. And the secretary of the AEA wrote back a letter that said in full, quote, while our middle name is ethics, we have no code, hence I cannot comply with your request.
DeMartino learned there has actually been resistance by many economists to a formal code of ethics.
Economists have had an allergy to ethics for much of the profession's existence. Certainly throughout the 20th century, economists have thought of themselves as kind of objective scientists doing objective scientific work.
But so much has changed in the wake of the global financial crisis. There are mounting criticisms that more economists should have warned of the housing bubble. And then the recent film Inside Job highlighted academic economists providing testimony about the meltdown even as they were getting paid by financial firms. All of this sparked nearly 300 economists to send a petition to the American Economic Association ahead of its annual meeting. It urges the group to adopt a formal ethical code, much like what doctors follow, lawyers, journalists too.
I think the public generally has a growing distrust of economists.
Christian Weller signed the petition. He teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Over coffee one morning at the conference, he says a formal code would restore credibility to the profession.
Whenever you turn on the TV, whenever you open a newspaper, there's some economist pontificating about something. And I think that the public should know whether the opinion from the economist is truly a neutral, credible opinion, or whether there is some real clear financial interest at stake here.
But some prominent economists like David Colander of Middlebury College still bristle at this notion of a formal code. One evening in the bar of the Sheridan Hotel, Colander tells me only a small slice of the profession even takes advisory roles with think tanks or politicians.
Economists do all kinds of different things. And to have a code that's going to capture what they do is quite hard.
Colander says economists should be disclosing conflicts of interests, but universities and government should do the policing. The University of Denver's George DiMartino isn't sure a formal code is as necessary as the conversation that's taking place.
The most important economists in the world who make decisions that bear on the life chances of millions of people have not had 5 minutes of training at any point in their professional careers in the ethical issues that arise in economics. I'm not aware of any other important profession about which that could be said.
The only concrete action to come out of the convention was a unanimous vote to re-examine standards of practice and the ethical challenges facing economists. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.